Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. If it's Friday, it must be Scott Braddock. If it's Scott Braddock, it must be the voice of Texas, the editor of the Quorum Report, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. I want to remind my audience that we tape this show on Thursday morning, so if anything interesting or horrific happens on Thursday night, we're going to miss it. Oh, damn it. Anyway, Scott Braddock, welcome back to the program. So what's going on in the great state of Texas?
Lots is happening. This is Texas OU weekend, the Red River rivalry. The governor joked earlier this week that he would close down the border crossings along the Red River. That would, of course, mean that people from Oklahoma could not come into Texas. And it's Texas OU weekend, Arnie. University of Texas and OU in Oklahoma will battle it out in Dallas, as they always do. Years ago, a friend of mine who passed away just recently, he was the stadium voice of the Dallas Cowboys, a guy named Roger Emmerich, used to be a reporter in Austin. And the thing with the Texas-Oklahoma rivalry for football is that Texas always has a home game. They always play it in Dallas. It's never in Oklahoma. And it's basically because Dallas is halfway between, Oklahoma City and Austin.
Okay.
And they have the facilities there. And so the world's sports journalists descend on Texas for this event, on the weekend. And the governor at the time, Ann Richards, was asked the question, is it not unfair that Oklahoma never gets a home game in this situation?
I can't imagine her response. Keep going.
Well, Governor Richards points to Roger Emmerich, my friend, at the time, who's there covering the press conference along with everybody else. And she knew that he, specialized in sports as well during his career. And she points at Roger and says, I'm going to let Roger Emmerich handle that question. And every sports reporter from all over the world started to ask him about that, and he explained the history of it. It was just a wonderful moment. That's how they used to deal with the press in Austin, and now they ban you from the Senate floor, and they try to trade your credential away to a dark money group. It's all very different.
It is all very different. So obviously the story du jour is we've been talking for weeks, if not months, about this secret tape that involves a dark money group, and of course your Speaker of the House, Speaker Bonin. And I have been, waiting, chomping at the bit, going, so when are they releasing the damn tape? When are they releasing the damn tape? So, bring some of my folks up to speed just in case they may have forgotten, but they've heard it every week. How could they? And let's talk a little bit about the fact that the tape may, in fact, be unveiled next week.
That is what we're hearing this morning. Just to reset this for folks, because it is sort of a complicated scandal. I guess it's kind of complicated.
Mm-hmm.
You have a dark money group in Texas that worked for a decade against the former Speaker of the Texas House, Joe Strauss, always battling with him, saying that he was too liberal. This is this sort of right-wing enforcement group that we always hear about, Arnie, funded by, we know of one of their big funders, a guy named Tim Dunn, who's from Midland, Texas, and sort of the big oil money guys. Cisco, Texas, is also a part of this. A pair of guys named the Wilkes brothers, who you may have heard
of. Yes, I've heard of the Wilkes brothers.
Funded Ted Cruz in a lot of his campaigns as well. We don't know where all the money comes from for this group called Empower Texans, because they run three organizations that all have the same name under different, organized differently. So one is a 501c3, one's a 501c4, and one is a political action committee. Of course, the PAC has to, release their contributors. They have to report that to the Texas Ethics Commission. But the politically active nonprofits don't have to, as you know all too well. Well, this group has been, for years, has just been attacking Republicans as insufficiently conservative.
Right.
And the new speaker.
It's been cleansing. It's been cleansing the Republican Party. That's the word, cleansing.
The new Speaker of the House, who came in after Strauss retired last year, is a guy named Dennis Bonin. And Bonin, a lot of people thought that he would kind of be like a Strauss 2.0. Now, I never was under this illusion because I know Dennis Bonin for years, and he's just not, he and Joe Strauss are just not the same guy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying anything good or bad. They're just not the same person.
They're not cut from the same fabric.
Not at all. And, you had to wonder, because Bonin has always been sort of a hothead, always somebody who, had the potential to twist off. He's been in the legislature for about 25 years, and so we know this guy around here in Austin. He's a known quantity.
Mm-hmm.
Well, throughout the first half of the year, Arnie, Bonin, was sort of setting himself up as the enemy of Empower Texans, that he would be sort of Strauss-like in that regard. In fact, earlier in the year, Bonin had said that this dark money group this right-wing enforcement group. He said, quote, "You can't appease these people, and I'm sure as hell not going to waste my time trying." That was his quote during the legislative session, because they, you know, this group was arguing that conservative results weren't coming out of the legislative session. Well, for whatever reason, after saying all that on the record and trashing Empower Texans for months, really, Bonin had a meeting with the spokesman for Empower Texans, a guy named Michael Quinn Sullivan, in the speaker's office at the Texas Capitol. And here's what they are alleged to have talked about. Bonin is supposed to have said to Sullivan that it's okay if you primary Republicans next year as long as you just keep it to these 10. And he is alleged to have given him a list of 10 members. Now, Bonin denies that there was a list. Michael Quinn Sullivan, this guy who is not an honest broker, and you know nobody can take anything that he says at face value, he came out and said, well, Bonin is lying. And it's not true that he didn't give me a list. And Sullivan said, I have a recording of our meeting. I taped it. Now, it's my understanding, Arnie, that the way that he taped it was to simply place his iPad on the table in front of the speaker and let it roll, let it record.
Right.
Well, just this morning, this guy Sullivan put out an email to his supporters that says that, he has gotten the go-ahead from his legal team to go ahead and release the tape, and it will come out next week. That's what we're hearing now. In the meantime, law enforcement has gotten involved. There may have been an illegal quid pro quo here because the speaker is also accused of promising to give this dark money group media credentials for the Texas House so that they would have direct floor access during the next legislative session in exchange for primarying these 10 Republican members who are said to be insufficiently conservative. So it's a big hot mess. You have political fundraisers this weekend in Dallas that are all around, all organized around the football game I started out talking about, the Texas OU. It's a tradition every year.
Right.
The Texas OU weekend in Dallas, there are legislative fundraisers all over the city. And so the speaker will be there, the governor, the lieutenant governor, lots of Texas House members will be there. And then next week, here's why the timing of this is important, Arnie. If this tape comes out, and you know what we heard about the tape as we talked about here on the show, is that the speaker talks in a very offensive way about women, about gay people, about these 10 members of the House who he targeted.
He conducted a lot of business with that conversation.
A lot of business, 1 hour conversation.
Yeah, unbelievable.
Yeah, after trashing this group for months, in a 1 hour conversation may have destroyed all of that. And by the way, the Republican members of the House, most of them felt pretty good about the fact that this speaker was, sort of at war with this group. You know, they thought, at least that part of the Joe Strauss legacy is continuing, that this guy is, against these far-right groups. And in fact, I should add in here that far-right group also spent about $100,000 against Speaker Bonin in his own primary for Texas House just last year. So the idea that he'd be trying to cut a deal with them is just sort of crazy to people. Next week, the Texas House Republican Caucus will have their retreat. Every year they get together in Austin and play golf and have dinner, and it's a big fundraiser here, on the weekend. And if this tape comes out right before that caucus retreat, it'll be the first time that all of the Republican Texas House members have gotten together in one place since this controversy, first sort of erupted. And you'll have to wonder, I will go there to check it out. I'll be dutifully reporting, Arnie.
Sure.
I'll be trying to figure out whether or not the caucus retreat feels more like a party or more like a funeral. We'll find out.
So my question is, how are the Democrats responding to this? So you just told me that there's going to be this big fundraiser for the time of the big football game. So there's going to be lots of people, lots of attention, lots of press.
Democrats and Republicans.
Right. But how are they, like, are the Democrats doing anything like Arnie would do, a little kamikaze-like? And what that means is, are they, like, buying billboards? What's on the tape, Speaker Bonin? Or doing something just to sort of raise the drumbeat before this tape is released, to do it at a time to make sure everybody is sort of going to be focused and on the same page. This is an opportunity to sort of make Bonin uncomfortable at this big event, which is exactly what you want to do. I just feel sometimes that, Democrats play so nice in the sandbox, and then you've got these dark money groups, and you've got Bonin, like, flipping on what, you thought was his agenda, so he's clearly not a reliable speaker when it comes to who he's trashing and who he's holding hands with. I just try to figure out, so, like, at what point in time do you say, this sucks. This just really and as I was talking to you just before the show, and I want everyone to know this, I said to Scott, so I've been hearing this story about this dark money group and what's been going on and how insidious it is and how it has tried to sort of cleanse the Republican Party, and now it's got the speaker in trouble. And I just saw the beginning of a documentary that was actually produced in 2018 but was more released in 2019. It was called Dark Money. And it got like 95% at Rotten Tomatoes, just to let you know. And it's really about all the dark money that's flooding elections nationwide. But it focuses on the state of Montana. I am just telling you, everyone, as I was watching it, all I kept doing was going, oh, God, every Texan should be watching this. As this tape rolls out, understand dark money hurts everyone. It doesn't. You think that it's going to be helping the Republicans. It's not. It's hurting the Republicans. It's hurting our sense of our relationship to democracy. It basically says that this isn't about your choice. It's really about their choice, because not only is this insidious, is this not only unlimited money, but it creates a false choice when you walk into a primary. And I just think this, especially in a place like Texas, where the primary is so important, because for the most part, if you win the primary, you win the general, especially for the longest period of time, that may be changing. But I just want people to know dark money is not only unhealthy for democracy, but Republicans, wake up. You now think you want it. It is now biting you in the proverbial ass.
It's bad for Republicans. It's bad for democracy. It's bad for Democrats. It's fairly bad for everybody. My basic principle on all this has been just say, if you're going to speak in public, if you're going to participate in politics, everyone has a right to know who you are.
Exactly.
Who's behind the message.
Exactly.
This is what I usually tell Republican groups when I talk about dark money, and you'll see their heads sort of nodding up and down in agreement. Under current Texas law, you could set up a 501c4 nonprofit that buys ads in political elections, and it could be called Conservatism Rocks, and it could be completely funded by George Soros, and you would have no way to know that.
And they all
sort of look like, wow, what? But that's what's going on. No one knows about that. I'll tell you about this tape, Arnie. The Texas Democratic Party, to answer your question, is suing to try to get this tape released. Democratic members of the Texas House have not said very much about this at all. Keep in mind, Speaker Bonin was elected unanimously by all the Republicans and Democrats in the Texas House. And so there's a lot of nervousness about what may be on this tape and whether or not it means that any Democrats might not ever be able to vote for him again based on what some of his offensive comments may be. The Texas Democrats just this week filed a motion in court here in Austin demanding the release of the tape within 3 days, which may be what's forcing the hand of this dark money group now.
So you mentioned that law enforcement is asking Texas House members for information in the investigation of the speaker. So where are they? What does that mean? Where are they going? What tree are they? Are they barking up? Because I understand what Bonin did. I understand about the dark money group. But I'm just trying to figure out what would other members of the legislature have to do with this.
It's very interesting. The Texas Rangers who are investigating this. Alleged quid pro quo, whether or not there was any, solicitation of a bribe, anything like that, that may have happened in this meeting. They've been slipping letters under the doors of the offices, into the members of the legislature, their Capitol offices this week. These letters that ask the members to turn over any, and I'll quote from it here, as part of the investigation, requesting House members to turn over, quote, any testimony, recordings, documents, records, or other information relevant to this investigation. They're just casting a wide net trying to figure out what is going on here. Did the Speaker of the House engage in any illegal behavior when he had this meeting in the Capitol? By the way, having such a political meeting in the Capitol would be illegal. I talked to staffers who work in the Texas Capitol, who also work on campaigns. Staffers will sometimes work on campaigns, often work on campaigns, but they'll go out of their way, because it's not legal to have political meetings in the Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
They won't even bring political shirts into the Texas Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
If they're going to do any campaign work, they leave the office at the Capitol and go home and work on it, or go work on it in a coffee shop.
Right.
The Speaker of the House had a political meeting in his office, and that's not in dispute. And so that is an issue. He was also, one of the things that may have gone on here that could potentially be a violation is it's not legal to raise cash to ask for political contributions during the legislative session and during the veto period. The governor has a few weeks in which he can decide whether to sign or veto legislation, mm-hmm. and you're not allowed to raise cash during that time either. This meeting was held in the Capitol during the veto period, which would also be potentially illegal because the speaker was asking for political contributions to be spent against specific Republican members in their primaries. That's the allegation. Again, he denies it. But we'll see. So if there were other members who knew anything about that, the Rangers want to know. And I would say one other thing that's very interesting. In this letter from the law enforcement, they're asking that those records be turned over by House members.
Yeah.
Respectfully requested before October 17th, which is next week, next Thursday, and that is the day that the Republican caucus retreat starts in Austin.
Oh my God! This, you know,
so you may literally have the Speaker of the House at the Republican caucus meeting, walking around asking members, did they turn anything over to the cops about him?
It's you know, again, I want this almost feels like we're mirroring what's going on in Washington. You know, the idea of the quid pro quo, all these things that are happening. And I just want people to know at this point in time, it is so unhealthy for the Republican Party in Texas to have this happen right at a point in time where we're beginning to see this real surge in a different base, a changing demographic, what we saw with Beto. All these things are suggesting that they may be at a pivot point to change. But then you've got the rot in Washington. You've got what's going on with the Kurds in Washington. Mm-hmm. Then you have this happening here, which feels a little bit like an echo chamber of the bad behavior of the president. And you keep thinking, oh, my God, of all the times for Bannon to do something so incredibly stupid. But in a way, it says this is what happens when you've been in control for too long. Mm-hmm. You almost forget that, you know, you too can walk off the edge. And that's exactly what he did. And, of course, why would you ever trust a dark money group? Because they're not your friend. You know, they will be your enemy tomorrow as quickly as they'll be your friend today. And that's the whole problem, is they're not reliable. The only thing that they're reliable about is that they know how to hurt and they know stealth.
Yeah, and it's interesting that this scandal, the quote-unquote victims would be the members themselves.
Yes.
You know, the members of the legislature. It's gotten a lot more attention than I would have thought that it would get, Arnie, because usually when it's speaker politics, you know, it's sort of an insider's concern. You know, people here in Austin would care about it, but mm-hmm. not really anywhere else. But this has been covered in all the major dailies in Texas, some of the television stations around the state, and actually has gotten national exposure as well. It's been
in
the New York Times.
Right.
And so, you know, I think that it is not something that the average voter is going to care about. I can tell you that the average primary voter in on the Republican side certainly does care about this. I'm hearing about it from GOP voters all across the state who think there may be some sort of corruption that has occurred here with the speaker, so they're worried about it. But I think to the average voter, the details of all this may not matter, but what it does say is that you have all this work that was done by Republican leadership to sort of put on this face of being able to get things done. Mm-hmm. Republican unity delivers results. That's what their big theme was coming out of the legislative session when, remember, there were not all these fights about social issues. We didn't have a bathroom bill. We weren't talking about
undocumented
immigrants.
Economy and taxes and everything
else. Let's focus on public schools, on taxes, followed closely by public schools and taxes. And that's all they wanted to talk about. And as soon as the legislative session is over, the speaker has this meeting, politically sort of sets himself on fire. And now you have people asking, why doesn't the governor call a special session?
He's terrified.
Why doesn't the governor address various issues that people are concerned about? And state government, for the moment, is broken.
Yeah.
It's like a car that won't start. If the speaker convened the House today at the behest of the governor to address gun violence, okay, we may be Republicans, but we do realize we need to do something about guns. The lieutenant governor's been going around the state trying to convince Republican primary voters that some form of gun control should be acceptable, mm-hmm. Given what happened, in West Texas, in Odessa, and in El Paso, in the mass shootings there. Of course, the Republican base is not going along with that at all. But if they convene the House, the first thing that might happen, probably would happen, some Republican members would want to try to remove the Speaker of the House, which would be a complete meltdown. So it's like the car won't start. They might want to go somewhere but they can't even get the engine to turn over.
All right. So talk to me a little bit about how Texas Republicans are responding to Donald Trump's removal of troops from northern Syria. It's just incredible. I mean, in a lot of ways, remember when he said I could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and still get reelected? Well, I don't know. Is there a Fifth Avenue in Syria where the Kurds are? Because he's killing, mass murdering. I mean, this blood is going to be on his hands. And I think that's one of the reasons why people are so – I mean, we talk about the kind of damage he does. Now we're talking about the blood he's spilling.
Senator Ted Cruz, Congressman Dan Crenshaw, and others immediately came out and said that this move to get rid of the troops in northern Syria is a terrible, terrible betrayal and the wrong thing to do. Crenshaw, who's from the Houston area and one of the sort of rising stars in the Republican Party, this is the veteran who you may remember was on Saturday Night Live when they him and Pete Davidson had that sort of come to Jesus moment.
Oh, yeah.
When they had been making fun of his eye patch. Which he lost the use of one of his eyes in combat. Crenshaw put out the tweet, quote, "Our small and cost-effective force in northern Syria plays an important role in maintaining stability and the upper hand on ISIS.
Right.
Allowing the Turkish military to take the territory risks igniting more fighting and destabilization." This tweet, Arnie, came out before we saw that Erdogan was moving his troops into northern Syria.
What
we were told was going to happen happened, right?
I know.
You see Lou Dobbs calling Ted Cruz a rhino, calling Mike Huckabee a rhino because they don't support President Trump on this. And Dobbs had said on his program on Fox, I believe on Fox Business Channel, had said, Syria is a country of 18 million people, and we're just moving 1,000 troops out. Those 18 million can defend themselves. It's never been about them defending themselves. This is what we were always told by Republicans, that we have to fight them over there so we don't have to fight them over here. Does anybody remember the Bush doctrine and the Bush years? That's what everything was about. And by the way, to now call these folks rhinos, Republicans in name only, people like Ted Cruz, it's enough to make you think that none of this was ever about being conservative, and it was all about fealty to Trump and whatever it is he wants to do. And by the way, they announced this late on a Sunday night. I'm trying to remember what time it was, but it was late on Sunday night. They said they were going to do this, and immediately there was backlash from Republicans saying that this is exactly the wrong thing to do. Democrats as well joining in and saying, no, we can't just abandon our allies who have been there trying to help us fight ISIS.
Well,
again, the people who want to kill us. This is not about defending people in Syria, even though that is part of it. But this is more about the interests of the United States. And a lot of the speculation, of course, Arnie, has been that with the impeachment pressure mounting on President Trump, that he needs to go ahead and pay his debts, do the things that he has promised to world leaders that he would do, because it's not clear how much longer he'll be in office.
So I posted this on Facebook. I woke up in the middle of the night, I think 4 a.m., and I wrote, "Attention world, U.S., even GOP. You are all expendable as long as I win. Yours, the Donald." And the reason I was so upset about what's happening with the Kurds is that they're actually, in a lot of ways, they've been sort of been responsible for sort of protecting us from ISIS because ISIS has been warehoused there. And what was amazing was, I think it was last night or maybe this morning, where he said, well, that's not a problem. If ISIS gets released, they'll just go to Europe anyway. That's where they'll go. So we're gonna send out all these very angry terrorists, and not a problem. They're going to go to Europe anyway. That was his answer. Think about this. And I hate to break it to you, but they could probably get a plane ticket and they could come here too. I mean, you know, he has no comprehension and he has no sense of responsibility. He has he doesn't understand empathy or guilt. Either one of them don't exist in his lexicon. And I just think that it's so ironic that now all these Republicans are now sort of, you know, beating on their chests because they're so horrified by this, because they understand the consequences of his behavior. And now it's a consequence that really, in some ways, they may trash democracy, but they want to see that their country survives. And I think they're beginning to realize that he is now more destructive than just undermining democracy. He could actually blow everything up.
Well, I think he's given them reasons. Trump is giving Republicans reasons to maybe not necessarily go along with this impeachment, but reasons to not stand in the way either.
Yes, Yes, they will be remarkably quiet. All right, really, really quickly before I let you go, that Donald Trump is going to have a mega event in Dallas.
Yes.
And what is Beto planning for his arrival?
Beto will stage a counter rally, just like we saw. You may remember when President Trump was in El Paso. This was back before the horrible shooting there. But the main topic, of course, was the border wall. And Trump was saying that, you know, El Paso, they always say it's so safe, and it's because there's a wall here. With Beto, basically with a rally that was about the same size as the president's rally.
Right.
One of my friends from who was a reporter at the Houston Chronicle, Jeremy Wallace, was there. Had the numbers first. Look, you know, this guy, Beto O'Rourke, with just about as many people on scene as the president. And I think we may see a similar sort of thing unfold in Dallas next week, the same day that the Republican caucus retreat starts in Austin. In Dallas on the 17th, you'll have Trump at American Airlines Center. He's going to sort of try to rally his troops. And interestingly, and I know you're running out of time here, but interesting that this will be, I think, his 12th or 13th trip to Texas as president, the most trips of any Republican who did not live here in Texas. And so it tells me, Arnie, that they must be sort of nervous about what's going on here in Texas with the shifting demographics, and more importantly than that, the shifting election results in 2018, where you had statewide Republicans come within about 2 points of losing their races. About a dozen new Democrats in the Texas House, two new Democrats in the Texas Senate, and two congressional districts that flipped from Republican to Democrat in Houston and Dallas. You would think the president would want to put in a little more investment here in this state.
And on that note, Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report. He's known as the Voice of Texas. He also is the dean of the Austin Press Corps. He joins us every week. We tape on Thursday for this show to air on Friday. But as Texas goes, so goes the nation. And if it changes in 2020, holy crap. That's all I have to say. Thank you so much for joining us, Scott Braddock. I really appreciate it.
We'll all see it unfold together, Arnie. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Okay, folks, our second part of the attitude is not going to be focusing on unions, which is what we thought, because we had a little girl 3 years old who said, no, my mom is not going to be talking to you about union organizing. So we went back into the archives and realized this is the absolute best time to bring back Sandy Levinson. He's a professor of law at Texas Law School. He wrote a book called Fault Lines in the Constitution. We are seeing fault lines everywhere with Donald Trump. This is an old interview from August. It's incredibly timely, and he is absolutely brilliant. You could listen to Sandy Levinson every week and say, I want more. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arnesen. When we come back, we're talking a little bit about the Constitution. Yeah, this will be fun.
A tiny green insect does major damage on this current cast. Tens of millions of ash trees in the U.S. have fallen victim to an invasive insect called the emerald ash borer. That's not just a problem for forest. Trees are important for water quality.
The roots help control the nitrates and phosphates, which are some of the pollutants that can enter streams and waterways. They also hold the soil in place.
Alicia Trexler of the Western Pennsylvania Conservancy has organized numerous tree plantings in her state. She says she no longer plants ash trees at these events.
I don't want to plant food for bugs.
And she's not alone. Many communities have stopped planting ash and have begun monitoring and management efforts to try to protect existing trees. Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future and made possible by the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. Online at currentcast.org.
Hey, do you know about the USA? Do you know about the government? Can you tell me about the Constitution? Learn about the USA. In 1787, I'm told, our founding fathers did agree to write a list of principles for keeping people free. The USA was just starting out, a whole brand new country. And so our people spelled it out, the things that we should be. And they put those principles down on paper and called it the Constitution. And it's been helping us run our country ever since then. The first part of the Constitution is called the Preamble and tells what those founding fathers set out to do.
We the people in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility. Provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare at hand, secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. In 1787, I'm told, our founding fathers all sat down and wrote a list of principles that's known the world around. The USA was just starting out, a whole brand new country, and so our people spelled it out. They wanted a land of liberty, and the preamble goes like this. We the people, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility. Provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare at hand, secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Dave Scott. Well, here's the good news. We just hung out with Scott Braddock, the editor of the Quorum Report. And of course, we were talking about Bonin-gate or Bozzy-gate or Bananengate or whatever it was. And I decided that I wanted to interview an author of a book. The title of the book is Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. And we're really seeing those flaws in bold relief. And one of the authors of the book, it's a husband and wife team, is joining us. Sanford Levinson, Sandy, is an American constitutional and legal scholar. But the part I love best of his bio is, and has been a law professor at the University of Texas, boy, my ears are burning, for almost 40 years. He is also the author of several books for adults on the Constitution, including Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance, and An Argument Open to All, Reading the Federalists in the 21st Century. So let me welcome our professor of law from the University of Texas. What a thematic hour this is going to be. Welcome to the program, Sandy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me.
So, Fault Lines in the Constitution. I saw the musical 1776, which of course is not about the Constitution, but the Declaration of Independence. But it was one of the most remarkable musicals or plays I'd seen in a long time. And instead of me being joyous at the end of 1776, I was heartbroken. I was in tears about the compromises that had to be made in order for them to get to this declaration. And then when you sort of move forward and look at the Constitution, you realize that that too is a piece of paper that both represents ideals but also represents compromise. And we're talking 1776 and the late 1700s, when the only people that were able to participate in any of these writings were white men of property, basically Protestant. And when you look at the country today in 2019, what you begin to realize is that even with the accelerating changing demographic, we have expanded the opportunity to participate in this great experiment to women, to people of color, to non-Protestants, to the people that rent, to younger people. So obviously, who can participate in America is a very changing face. But obviously, the Constitution didn't necessarily anticipate these changes. So as you write your book, Fault Lines in the Constitution, what were the things that sort of jumped out at you with this original document that says, you know what, maybe there were problems. Could they have anticipated them? Maybe not. But today when we look back, is it a document that is assisting us or holding us back?
Right. That's a great question. We end up with 20 fault lines, and Some of them are low-hanging fruit that almost everybody today, you know, is aware of, the Electoral College. Right. Others are quite esoteric, but under certain circumstances, remarkably important. We talk about continuity in government. What if Flight 93 had, in fact, run into the Capitol, crashed into the Capitol, and killed or disabled dozens of senators or hundreds of representatives? It turns out that the Constitution makes it almost literally impossible to reconstitute a government under those sorts of conditions, because every member of the House of Representatives has to be elected.
Right.
And that obviously presents problems if, say, 300 members of the House have been killed, and then you have to wait around for several months to replace them. And then there are a lot that are in between, including, for example, the fact that it takes, in contemporary time, a long time between election and inauguration of new presidents, and that itself can generate crises, the presidential veto power. I want to say two things about your issue you set up in your introduction. One is that Cynthia and I don't engage in what I sometimes call founder bashing, that we do try to say, this is what they were faced with.
Oh, yes.
And
oh,
what
absolutely.
They were faced with was whether or not you could form a new constitution, and dreadful compromises had to be made.
Exactly.
So the analogy I've used in some of my own work is the alliance with Stalin in World War II, which I think was eminently justifiable.
Huh.
But, you know, he was Joseph Stalin.
Right, exactly.
And the people we bash, frankly, are ourselves, because we don't have what the framers had, which was the audacity to say, are we being well served by the Articles of Confederation? Is it, in fact, an imbecilic system, which is what Alexander Hamilton said,
yes.
And do we need to do something about it?
Right. No, and I am not a founder bashing at all. You heard me say I was in tears. And
right.
I was in tears because I understood, you know, even as it was hard to understand, given, you know, how I'm raised and who I am today in the, you know, in the 2000s. And yet you have to step back and look at what they were faced with and the challenges they were faced with. And the idea that compromise by definition means that there are losers and there are winners. And that ultimately what you're trying to do is move forward, and maybe it's not necessarily and always the direction you want to go, but they clearly did. They changed a world, let alone changed a country.
Right.
So you know that you have to sort of celebrate the power of this. You can also grieve about some of the things that they set in place that they didn't
that's
intend.
That's exactly right.
Exactly.
And what's ended up, and I think, you know, frankly, I'm not a big fan of plays like 1776, because instead of celebrating their audacity and their willingness to break idols, which is one of the reasons, incidentally, I really love Hamilton, because it doesn't say that what he did is engraved in stone.
Right.
What it does is to say that, you know, a remarkably young person, he was, depending on when you think he was born, he was no older than 21 or 22
oh my God.
At the time of the American Revolution.
Isn't that amazing?
That, you know, you could and should rise up. And instead, we tend to look at the founders as, in fact, you know, writing in stone sacred scripture that we're bound to follow. They didn't believe that.
And absolutely.
We shouldn't believe that.
So let me just say something. So I did see 1776, but I want to just give you a proviso here. One of the beauties of the production that I saw was that they brought another professor and myself in, and we did a hour Q&A mm-hmm. afterwards. And that's where you really got to sort of talk about the things that you and I are now talking about now.
Right.
And I
yes.
think almost every one of these productions almost needs that kind of texture in order for us to sort of think out loud beyond what is only possible within these things. But let's talk about the fact that – so if you had to triage – okay, Sandy, I'm going to make you like, you know, despot for the day.
Okay.
If you had to triage and you had to pick five things you think are critical – that must be changed, and you could change them in the course of the next week or two of the Constitution. And you said that there were 20 things that you focused on. Obviously, 20
right.
is a heavy lift. But there are things that you can sort of say are, from a priority perspective, would really make a significant difference in how we move our country forward. And let me just say one thing. So I've been talking to presidential candidates and talking about the 2020 campaign. And I said the 2020 campaign needs to focus on three things, Sandy. It needs to recognize fear. And fear is legitimate, whether it's fear of climate change, whether it's fear because of the economic inequality, whether it's fear because of race wars, whether it's fear because of the changing manufacturing sector, whatever it is. There is legitimate fear in the Midwest, in the East Coast, whatever. So you have to recognize and appreciate the fear. Then you have to recognize that we have this sort of sense of urgency. Things need to change, and they need to change in a way that is so swift, something that historically Congress has never been capable of doing. And then the third thing that a 2020 candidate needs to sort of do is give us a sense of hope. You know, give us a roadmap that says this is possible and these are the ways we can do it. So given those three things, you now have a Constitution, which to some extent is an impediment to
right.
the understanding of urgency
right.
and to embracing hope. What would be the five things you would think that we should do if we could triage?
Okay. Inevitably, my answer depends on kind of on when you're asking the question. But we're talking about the summer of 2019.
Correct.
So right now, I would put first and foremost the fact that the impeachment clause turns out to be a disaster rather than a genuine hope.
Wow.
So if I could rewrite the Constitution, the first thing I would do is to substitute a procedure for a vote of no confidence, or, as in Wisconsin or California, a procedure for a recall election. What is awful about the impeachment clause, frankly, is that it's been taken over by lawyers. So we get into these endless conversations about what counts as a high crime and misdemeanor,
exactly.
what is obstruction of justice, et cetera, and lawyers simply shout at each other and the public become cynical. If we had a no-confidence procedure, we wouldn't have lawyers shouting at one another. Rather, the conversation would be, do you have confidence in this person
Beautiful.
To make decisions
Beautiful.
About matters of life and death,
No.
peace and war? And the answer has to be no.
Right.
But the Constitution, the national Constitution, and one of the important things about our book is that we do a lot of comparisons, not only with other national constitutions, but with American state constitutions, which are incredibly interesting and which tend to be ignored by
wow.
most Americans.
Wow.
So that's the first thing I do.
So let me just mirror back to you, and let me just make sure I understand this. So right now, what the requirement is high crimes and misdemeanors, which of course is never defined, which is in part one of the reasons why lawyers sort of take over. So what you're saying is that since this is sort of an area of legalese and there's no definition, yada yada yada, it's about mañana, 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 and the thing drags out and there's never any closure. The simple question about no confidence is something that is more general. Understood.
Right.
It is something easier to get to. And are you telling me that in California, for example, you mentioned that you go to other state, you go to look at the state constitutions. In California, if they want to replace a leader, that's how they approach it. They don't approach it through an impeachment. They approach it through a no confidence.
No, what they did in California, you know, there was a vote, I think 2003, I believe it was, when the voters bounced Gray Davis
yes.
from the governorship through an initiative and referendum.
Okay.
Or in Wisconsin, though it was unsuccessful, Scott Walker
right.
had to face
okay.
a public vote of no confidence.
Okay.
We don't have any states that allow their legislatures to bounce a governor
mm-hmm.
through no confidence. But, of course, if you look abroad, A lot of people are talking right now about the fact that the first thing that's going to happen when the British Parliament comes back in September is that Boris Johnson is going to face a vote of no confidence.
Right, right.
And that's common in parliamentary systems. What is true about the American Constitution is that we are stuck for 4 years
Brilliant.
With a president, unless we're lucky enough to have a president where there is smoking gun evidence that he, or in the future she, is a crook. But that's a dumb system. And that is the first thing I would change. I'd say, second thing is the Electoral College, which is crazy in the way it operates. The third thing I would change is the difficulty.
I want to go back to the Electoral College only because I was interviewed by Newsy about this issue. Mayor Pete has made the Electoral College a very important thing. If you were to change the Electoral College, because there's a lot of conversation, would you eliminate it or would you change it?
I would. Well, my preference would be to eliminate it.
Okay.
But one of the things that is almost literally never thought about is that the Electoral College is a system and not simply this bizarre way by which, you know, we end up with a new president. The system says that if the Electoral College doesn't end up picking somebody with a majority,
right,
then it goes to the House of Representatives, and the House of Representatives votes on a one-state, one-vote basis. So imagine the following, which I don't think is wildly unrealistic. In 2020, there are three candidates or four candidates.
Mm-hmm.
There is Donald Trump, your favorite Democrat, whoever it might be, the representative from Michigan who has resigned from the Republican Party and is apparently very, very tempted to run as the president's candidate for the Libertarian Party, and a national unity ticket led by, say, John Kasich, with a conservative Democrat running as his vice president that gets Ohio's electoral vote, and the Democrat and Republican split the electoral vote. So there's no majority winner.
Okay.
It then goes.
What a nightmare. Keep going.
Yeah, one further thing. The Democrat comes in first, both in popular vote and electoral vote, but doesn't get a majority electoral vote.
Okay.
So it goes to the House.
Right.
It turns out, as is true this very day, when the Democrats have, I think, a 39 or 40 seat majority, 26 of the 50 delegations are controlled by the Republican Party.
I know.
So the 26 delegations say, we're going to vote for Donald Trump, who becomes president. This is crazy. It is the sort of thing that I think would provoke legitimate rioting in the streets.
Right.
But that is the Electoral College system. It's insane.
So I'm just telling you something, Sandy. Do me a favor. Will you get on, like, national television and talk to people about this? First of all, one, you're a great teacher. No. One of the reasons why I love Elizabeth Warren is that I knew her before she was, like, anybody.
Mm-hmm.
She was just a professor at Harvard.
Yep.
And I remember thinking, oh, my God, what a great teacher you are. Someday I hope you, like, you're in a place where you can teach a lot of people. And now she's in a place. You also are a good teacher. And I'm so glad I stopped you about the Electoral College because I get a very predictable answer about that. You gave me an unpredictable answer, but one that is more horrifying in some ways about the Electoral College. And what you are suggesting as a scenario is something that is actually quite realistic. You know, we saw things we couldn't even imagine in 2016. Well, given the nature of politics today, what you are describing is something that's incredibly real for 2020. And to create that, there would be rioting in the streets. And we already know that we're afraid of rioting in the streets because of a potential race war. Add the race war to this, and I can't even imagine what it will look like. So I think this is a very sobering conversation. Give me another issue.
Okay. Well, The difficulty of changing the U.S. Constitution is an independent fault line. And here again, if you look at the 50 American state constitutions, they're all easier to amend.
Yes.
My favorite state, and I'm not saying this simply because you're from New Hampshire, is New Hampshire because of its constitution.
Mm-hmm.
that, as you well know, exactly, the Constitution requires that New Hampshire voters have the opportunity now every 10 years mm-hmm. to vote yea or nay on whether or not to have a new state constitutional convention.
Right.
And you've had 17 of them.
So let me just share some
history.
Right. So, Sandy,
I think that's terrific. I think a huge fault line in the U.S. Constitution is that we have not had a second convention since 1787, and it is next to impossible to amend the Constitution with regard to anything truly important. And one of the things this leads to, I believe, is the reverse of the "if it ain't broke, don't fix it" mantra, which makes sense, that if you can't fix it, then we have to pretend it isn't broken. And since, in fact,
it is
unrealistic, often, to think of amending the Constitution with regard to anything that is controversial, then we have every incentive to say, you know, it really isn't that bad. And I think there are things that really are that bad. And we just don't talk about constitutional amendment because it sounds either foolish, that is, it can't really be done, or it requires that you implicitly say, you know, the framers might have been great men in many ways, but we shouldn't really feel locked in to decisions they made that really are dumb for our own time,
right,
even if arguably they made sense in 1787.
Hmm.
Our book concludes with a debate between Cynthia and myself. And as I always say, like most of my friends, family, and professional colleagues, she is appalled by the idea of having a new constitutional convention. I'm in a very small minority of, I hope, respectable legal academics who really do want a new constitutional convention. And I really do look to the American states as models, and no state is a better model than New Hampshire. And there are 13 other states yeah. that have similar provisions in their constitutions. And so, again, you know, if you give me the power to wave a magic wand,
yes.
One of the things I would do is to make it easier to amend the Constitution, partly because if it were easier to amend the Constitution, we would have more conversations like the ones we're having at this moment,
right,
where you invite me to say what would I change in the Constitution.
Right.
But usually that's, you know, kind of utopian or quixotic because we kind of all know that
happen.
We're locked into this Constitution. So let's just hope against hope that Donald Trump doesn't stumble into war or trigger a Great Depression because we're stuck with him for four very long years, given that impeachment doesn't work.
So real quickly, just to let you know, my first foray into politics in my great state of New Hampshire was in 1984 when I won my seat in the Constitutional Convention. That was That was the last Constitutional Convention we have had. We have not voted for one
right.
since 1984. I will tell everyone that it was the best 6 weeks of my life. It was one of the most remarkable experiences. It changed my life forever because you ran as a citizen. You did not run as a partisan. And I learned from some great Republicans. I am not a Republican. That's really how I learned to participate in electoral politics in New Hampshire, because that was the invitation in. And we were very sober in what we did as we looked at the Constitution. It was a remarkable conversation with these 400 and plus people. So I just want everyone to know the only concern I have about this, and I can understand why you and your wife would be fighting about this, and that is that what we now know because of decisions like Citizens United, what we now know know about dark money. What I'm seeing even in the Democratic 2020 race, where Tom Steyer is buying his place on the debate stage, is that now that kind of money could influence the outcomes of who could participate in a constitutional convention. And that is where the real taint is and the real fear is. Not having us talk about the Constitution, I think that's totally valid. I think we should reexamine it. I think there should be an approach that we do it on a fairly regular basis. I capiche that. But until we deal with the whole money and politics thing, that is what is so scary, because dark money is the problem. And we are now awash in dark money, especially with the kind of grotesque inequality we see in America. There is too much money in the top 0.1%, and the rest of us are sort of struggling along, and that means outcomes change.
You know, what I really would love more than anything else is for you and I to go on national television together and talk about your experience in the New Hampshire
convention. It was incredible.
Because your point is absolutely right, that citizens, if they're told that they can participate, can rise to the occasion.
Oh my God! I became in 1992. I became the first female nominee for governor in state history. Mm-hmm. How did I start? I started as a young, pregnant. I was pregnant. Person participating in the Constitutional Convention. It was a wash of my state. It was every issue. A lot of us, some of them more sophisticated. Trust me, there were some state reps that ran. There were some, the majority leader ran. But I would say a good significant portion of us were able to take that 6 weeks off and say, let's try this.
Yep.
And it really gave me a huge appreciation, both of the Constitution in my state, but also about why engagement in the political process was so crucial.
Right.
So you're absolutely right.
Actually, on the principle that if you're going to hang for a lamb, you may as well hang for stealing a sheep.
Yeah.
That if I could wave my magic wand, I would select the delegates to a convention basically at random,
I totally agree. Absolutely.
So this would avoid the genuine fear that you express.
Yes.
About the role of big money.
Absolutely.
In elections, because there wouldn't be elections.
And I need to let you go. So, Sandy, here's the deal. You're coming back, because we only got to two or three. I need at least three or four more. So I'm inviting you back. So just be prepared for another phone call.
Please.
Because I want to continue this conversation. And let me just say one more thing about the idea with jury selection. I have now appeared on two juries. I have learned more from the people on those juries than I may have learned in almost any other walk of life. There were guys that knew more, but one was a gun issue. Well, there were a lot of guys who knew a lot about guns. They taught us. They taught us, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, it was the celebration of who we are and what we bring to the table, our sphere of influence, our knowledge base, which is so different and discreet, and yet coming together, I think it gave people a real sense that you were being evaluated by your peers. And I think that's what's so important. The title of the book, Fault Lines in the Constitution. Buy it, read it, get your school to read it to your students. The framers, their fights, and the flaws that affect us today. Cynthia Levinson and Sanford Levinson have written this book. I recommend it. Sandy, you're coming back.
Anytime.
All right. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. We will see you next week. Ciao. You better think-